thereby let the cities grow large, an obstacle which the technology of any time earlier than the 20th century simply could not meet. There is no way that they could have built bridges across Delaware Bay. In fact, there is not one there to this day. We could do it now, but since there are no major cities in there, there's no point in doing it. There's no way they could have built a bridge across Chesapeake Bay until this century. If you are going to have commerce between your cities, you build the bridges in the narrow portions of the rivers that are a little bit upstream of the fall line in the Piedmont. You build your seaport in the wide portion that is a little bit downstream on the coastal plain. And so, as a result of geologic processes, which began in excess of 375 million years ago, Washington, D.C. is where it is today. Likewise, all the major cities, New York City, Trenton, Philadelphia, and so on down on the East Coast. Question?
What is that one region up there that looks like a big mud puddle?
And that one region that looks like a big mud puddle?
Yeah, below those, snow is.
Below the rivers.
Tell me what to do with the pointer. Move it up, move it down,
right,
move
there.
It sideways, right there? Okay, I'll get to that. I'll get to that.
And the top looks like a crater or a remnant.
No, there are no craters there. unless you believe the story about the Carolina Bays and they don't extend that far north. No, I'll get to that. Honest, I am going through the things you can see in this picture one strip at a time. And so far I've gotten as far as the fall line. Okay, the next strip that you have is the Piedmont, and you can see that is pretty uniform. You can see the fall line so clearly, especially down there, and the Piedmont is pretty uniform with one exception. Here and there you have ridges, and those are called trap ridges, and they are in these structures that I mentioned the existence of before and will tell you about later, called the Triassic lowlands. The edge of the Piedmont is where the Blue Ridge starts, and the Blue Ridge is dark in this picture. In fact, it appears blue in this picture as a result of the railway scattering. The Blue Ridge has a 50-mile gap where the Susquehanna River cuts through it. Then it picks up on the other side and becomes stronger and stronger as you go north. And on this side, it is conventionally not referred to by geologists as the Blue Ridge. However, it is the same thing, it's the same structure, it's there for the same reason. Geologists call that part of it the Redding Prong. And so the geologists would get upset if I called that the Blue Ridge, but it really is Blue Ridge, and I'm going to call it that for this lecture. The people who live there don't seem to have any names for it particularly. They call it, damn mountains over there. But geologically, it's the Redding Prong. And the reason is that it extends through down from New York State all the way down to the town of the city of Redding, Pennsylvania. And then, as I say, there's that gap in it where the Susquehanna cuts through. The next thing that you have is the Great Valley. Now, you may have noticed a pattern here. The high places, the ridges, tend to be dark in this picture, and the low places, the valleys, tend to be light. The reason for that is that 200 years of assiduous American farming has cleared off all of the lowlands and removed the forests that make them dark. But the forests have been left on the highlands. And so you have this geologic map, not entirely as a result of differences in the rocks, but as a result in differences of the farmability, which in turn are due to differences in the rocks. And if we had taken a picture such as this while the Indians were still living there and no one else, it would have been just uniform dark and would not have been nearly as geologically informative, and I wouldn't be using it in this lecture. On the other hand, if the Indians were still living here, I wouldn't be giving this lecture. So you see that it all cancels out. The Great Valley is there where it is because at that particular place, limestone comes to the surface. In the eastern part of the United States, limestone is a very easily erodible rock and almost always forms lowlands, valleys. The reason for that is that limestone is made of calcium carbonate. Remember that cement? And calcium carbonate, of all the major rock-forming minerals, is the most easily soluble in water. So in the humid regions, such as we live in, where there's a lot of rainfall and a lot of groundwater, limestone is eroded and forms valleys. What forms the ridges? Sandstones particularly. And here we have the first ridge in the Valley and Ridge Province, which is known by a dozen different names in different states. It is called Shanga Mountain in New York State, Shangunt, believe it or not, is spelled S-H-A-W-A-N-G-U-N-T. It is called Kittatinny Mountain as it crosses northern New Jersey. High Point, the highest place in New Jersey where there's a state park, is on Kittatinny Mountain. It is called Blue Mountain and some other names in Pennsylvania. Still further names farther south, Clinch Mountain in Tennessee is probably the best known of those. There's a folk music group active right now called the Clinch Mountain Boys, and they're named for it. But it's really all one mountain, and it is on... The reason for this there is that there is one particular stratum of sandstone, which is less easily erodible than any of these other major sedimentary rocks, a sandstone which is known as the Clinch Sandstone, in fact, for Clinch Mountain, and it's known by other names farther north. That mountain, that ridge of sandstone coming to the surface of that place, runs almost unbroken for 1,300 miles down the eastern United States. I don't know if there are any other longer single mountains on Earth. There certainly are no others in the United States. In fact, we say the largest mountain in the solar system is Olympus Mons on Mars. That is true if you're talking about sheer bulk. But if you're talking about length from one end to the other, Clinch Mountain makes even Olympus Mons look tiny. Then you have this intricate filigree, this beautiful curved series of shapes, which constitute the rest of the valley and ridge crop. There is one place up there where you have a boat-shaped ridge surrounding a valley, which happens to be in a rock that is not one of the major sedimentary rocks, but, well, there are several rocks in that valley, but one of them is not one of the major sedimentary rocks, limestone, sandstone, and shale, but it's one that is of extreme importance. It's coal. And that is one of the great anthracite mining regions of the eastern United States. The towns of Scranton and Wilkes-Barre are in that valley. I will explain to you the reason for this beautiful, intricate filigree shape in a moment. But take a look at this ridge here. It's all the same ridge on the same sandstone, but it keeps curving back and forth. And every time it curves, the locals gave it a different name. And so that ridge, just within the state of Pennsylvania, rejoices in no less than 12 separate names for its different portions. I have to tell you all this because if you're trying to trace this that I tell you, if you go home and look at an atlas and try to trace it on the map, you'll go nuts unless you realize that different mountains can be the same thing. In fact, the real problem with nomenclature of mountains in both the eastern and western United States, especially the west, is that very often, you know, the valleys were settled first. And very often, the same mountain was given different names at about the same time by settlers who named it from two different sides. And there are some places where, to this day, those controversies have not been resolved. Beyond the Valley and Ridge province, you have what you can see is the highest part, because that is the only place where there was still snow in May when this picture was taken. And these things, you can see they have a different shape to them than the ridges of the Valley and Ridge province. You can see that they are irregular, they're dendritic, that means shaped like a network of tree roots, and intricately but randomly eaten away. That is the dissected region that is the Appalachian Plateaus. Up here it's called the Allegheny Plateaus. A funny thing happens to the Valley and Ridge province in the northern part of this picture. And that is, it peters out with the exception of the one ridge that is called Kittatinny Mountain and so forth, Clinch Mountain in other words, in this part of the country, and the one Great Valley, which extends on up to be the Hudson's Valley. And so if you transect the Appalachians across here, you go across a severely abbreviated valley and ridge province, and then you hit the Appalachian Plateaus right there. And that is the portion which is referred to as the so-called Pocono Mountains down there and the so-called Catskill Mountains up there, which are not mountains at all, any more than the Ozarks are. They are simply part of the Appalachian Plateaus. The Ozarks are not, but the Poconos and the Catskills are simply part of the highly dissected Appalachian Plateaus. And the reason that they are unusually spectacular and unusually rugged and therefore in unusual demand as vacation sites, the reason is that they happen to be on sandstone, which is unusually rugged. The Catskills, particularly, just out of this picture up there, are in a sandstone with a very interesting origin. Back when the first set of mountains in the eastern United States formed 375 million years ago, or rather in the events of climax, at the collision of the continents 375 million years ago, Those mountains were a little bit east of, at least the high parts of them, were a little bit east of where we see the Appalachians today. What I'm referring to is the so-called Taconic Akkadian orogeny, the mountains produced by that. Orogeny means mountain building. And there were shallow seas to the west of them in those days, where these sediments that make up the Appalachian plateaus were deposited then. One of those sets of sediments was a delta of what must have been a river comparable in size to the Mississippi. Because that delta can be traced in the patches of it that are left from the Catskills, which are the toughest part of it, because that was closest to the mountains, which were the source of the debris, and therefore you had the biggest chunks of stuff there. You can trace that delta from the Catskills completely across New York State and into Ontario. A single river delta, 200 miles long. Sandstone, upstream sandstone conglomerates, which are the sedimentary rocks produced from even bigger grains than sand, and then you get finer sediments, which are deposited by the gentler waters downstream until it peters out as uninteresting shales and so forth somewhere around the St. Lawrence River. Oh, okay. I promised to get to the various answers to your questions, and let me ask you if there's anything left on the slide that you had, you know, that you were asking me about that I didn't incorporate in all that.
Well, you said you were going to explain how these occurred.
Yeah, I said I was going to explain the filigrees, and I will. But were there any other features on the slide? Like you said you saw something that looked like a crater.
Yeah,
and I don't know where you... Oh, this thing here?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
No,
yeah.
Just below it.
Well, there's another roughly circular feature there. Huh. You know, I never noticed that. I suspect, in fact, now as I look at it, I think that's all one river valley which has been made visible by a dam, by several dams causing lakes. I suspect that's coincidence. But every once in a while, when you look at these Skylab pictures, you run across features that look remarkably circular, and you wonder if they could have anything to do with meteorite craters. There was a big one 40 miles across in western Wisconsin that was discovered in Skylab pictures. And geologists are having a nice fight now over whether that could possibly be meteoritic. The problem is there's no evidence for it in the rocks. Rocks where a meteorite hits are very, very severely shocked and deformed, as I'm sure you can imagine by the intensity of the impact, and there's no evidence for that. On the other hand, if the crater is old enough, those severely shocked and deformed rocks are the first ones to be eroded just because they have been so badly chewed up. It could be that what we're seeing there is not the crater itself, but what is called an astrobleme, an interesting scientific term, comes from Greek words meaning star wound, and that is the deformation, the circular structure deformation produced in the rocks under where the crater was. And there are lots of cases of that sort of thing known, some of them quite large, and a number have been discovered in Skylab and Landsat photographs. Okay, so all right, let's go on to the next slide. Here is an absolutely magnificent Skylab picture. This was taken in color infrared film, which is a special film. This is not the way the eye would have seen it. It's a special film that shows near infrared wavelengths, which the eye cannot see, as a color that the eye can see, namely red. Red has to be shown as a different color there, therefore, it is shown as green, and green is shown as blue, and blue is not shown at all. So what you're seeing is what you would see if the color sensitivity of your eye were shifted upward towards the longer wavelength by an amount equal to one-third the width of the visible spectrum. This is approximately what some birds may see. We have reason to believe that there are birds which can see farther into the infrared than we can, but cannot see all the blue colors that we can. And you can see it's a very colorful world. You have autumn coloration all the time. Chlorophyll reflects infrared even more strongly than it reflects green. And so you might think, you know, I tell you, green appears as blue, so you might think leaves would appear blue. Actually, they appear red because they are even more bright in the infrared than they are in the green. And on the Blue Ridge there, where you have the forest, there is intense red vegetation. Elsewhere, where you have farmlands and people's lawns and so forth, it's less intense, but it's still that red which dominates so many of these color infrared photographs. This picture was taken not with one of the handheld cameras, such as the last one that I showed you was. That was just taken casually through the wardroom window, which they had cameras there just in case the astronauts saw something. It looked worth photographing, and there wasn't time to maneuver the spacecraft around, get it into the proper position for the really high-powered cameras to come into play. That's the reason that there was that curved edge to the photograph. It was actually at the edge of the wardroom window, which was circular. This picture, however, was taken with the multispectral photographic facility, or the S190A experiment, which was a set of six cameras that photographed each area on the ground simultaneously through six different colored, through six different filters and on different kinds of film simultaneously. So at the same moment as a picture like this was taken on color infrared film, you also would have had a picture on normal color film, which shows it the way the eye would have seen it. Those are usually not as pretty, and so I don't have as many of those in the tray here, the slide tray, that is. You also had them taken in various black and white films through various filters, some of them invisible light, some of them infrared. And it's that kind of information that you can use, for example, to find out what kind of crop is being grown in every single farm plot in this picture, or for that matter, in the entire United States or the entire world. And to do this in a period of only a few weeks. Skylab could photograph the entire United States on 300 pictures taken over a period of, well, 5 days in theory, but in practice it's going to be cloudy in a few places the first time, so call it a couple of weeks. And then he can reduce the data very quickly with computers. And if you try to do the same thing with high altitude aerial photography, it would require 500,000 pictures, which would take 20 years to get, by the end of which I think you can see the data would be of historical interest only. What that means is, for the first time in the 7,000-year history of agriculture, we have the capability to advise farmers during the growing season, while the information is still of use to them, how much of each kind of crop is being grown, so that for the first time in the history of agriculture, we can plan ahead to avoid shortages and surpluses. That is to say, we cannot do that yet because Skylab is experimental. We will be able to do this kind of thing within a few years as this kind of capability becomes routinely available the way weather satellite pictures are routinely available now. You can also detect, as a result of the difference in the shades of the infrared, crop diseases and insect infestations before the farmers on the ground are aware that anything is wrong. Because you can see infrared, but they can't. It's estimated that this capability alone will save just the United States a total of $45 billion over the next 20 years. And that's just the United States. For us, that's nice. Drives down the cost of food a little, okay. For Bangladesh, it can mean the difference between life and death for millions of people. And that is the best answer I know of, out of many, to this standard cliche question, why do you spend money on space when people are starving? We spend money on space because people are starving, and we hope to do something about it. Question here.
How does this type of information compare with the multispectral scan of the Landsat?
Question is, how does this type of information compare with the multispectral scanners on the Landsat series of unmanned satellites that do the same thing? And that is quite favorably. The Landsats have the advantage that being unmanned, see, here's an advantage of an unmanned spacecraft. When they work, they're nice, you know. They can stay up there all the time. You never have to bring them back. You never have to feed them. You never have to worry about, they work for 24 hours a day. You never have to worry about sleep and so forth and so on. Their scanners, however, are scanners. They are not photographs like this. So they don't have quite this magnificent definition. However, their definition is very, very, very good. And at the very end of the program, I'm going to recommend to any of you who are interested in this kind of thing, and I take it some of you are, a magnificent book of Landsat images of the entire Earth, which give not the kind of detailed description that I'm able to give in a lecture on a single area, of course, but still a lot of information on the geology, the forestry, the agriculture, all the things you can see in the picture, magnificently reproduced and available for only $14 because it was printed by the government, not by a commercial firm. So I'll mention that at the very end of the lecture, and I think some of you might be interested in sending away for it. Let me illustrate, though, what I want to show you the picture for, and that is, this is Baltimore, this is Washington, D.C. You can make out the streets in Washington, not quite the major buildings except the very, very largest ones on this scale. The little white things, of course, are clouds. Those are cumulus clouds. And you can see the fall line very, very clearly running down this picture. And note what happens to the Potomac as it goes over the fall line. See how much narrower it gets all of a sudden there in a zone of just a few miles in width. Then over here you've got the Blue Ridge Province, and then you've got the Great Valley, and you have just the very, very beginning of Clinch Mountain, or whatever they call it at that particular in that particular state, what I'm calling Clinch Mountain throughout the lecture, over there in the picture. I want to draw your attention to something very strange. The Potomac is running right through those mountains. You don't ordinarily expect a river to climb mountains and then eat its way down into them, do you? In fact, you generally expect rivers to run down valleys. But in the Appalachians, you see this kind of thing over and over and over again. Rivers running right across mountain ranges, which they could have avoided by going just a few miles out of their way, like so, or like down there. And yet they seem not to have bothered to do it. Reason why, I'll show you in a few moments. This is the way the Appalachians originally looked. This is a set of mountains which have just been formed. These are the Zagros Mountains in Iran, and this is a Gemini photograph, and you can recognize, those of you that remember the Gemini program history, this is the Agena target vehicle they docked with and its characteristic radar antenna. The Zagros Mountains are in the process of being formed at this very moment out of flat-lying sediments in a myogeous incline that are being squeezed together by plate tectonic motions at this very moment. This is a set of mountains which is largely uneroded. You can see erosion has done its work, but it's relatively minor. And I told you that you form folded mountains by taking a section of the crust and moving one edge towards the other in the same way as you might crumple a rug. What that means is, every place where it's folded up, there is a ridge on the top of that fold. Every place where it's folded down, there is a valley at the bottom. That sounds so obvious, you wonder why I'm insulting your intelligence by saying it. The reason is that except for the very youngest folded mountains such as these, or such as the coast ranges in California, those portions of them that are folded, you do not have anything like as simple as a single ridge along the top of the fold and a single valley along the bottom. Instead, what you have is shown in the next few slides. This is a picture of the original set of folds, and there you see there is a ridge along the top and there is a valley along the bottom, and the topography, where it's up and where it's down, corresponds to the structure, where it's folded and where it isn't. Generally, those folds are not, if you run a line along the top of the fold, it is not perfectly horizontal. Generally, if you go on a sufficient number of miles, the fold bends down into the earth, plunges down into the earth. Those are referred to as plunging folds. There are exceptions to that. Kittatinny Mountain, Clinch Mountain, whatever you want to call it, 1,200 miles long, is the remnant of a fold which is perfectly horizontal along that entire distance. In fact, Kittatinny comes from an Indian word, and so does Appalachians from a different tribe, meaning endless mountains. And in the case of Kittatinny Mountain or Clinch Mountain, whatever you want to call it, it just about is. Generally, though, you will find that the folds are not perfectly horizontal. Now, the effect of erosion to a first approximation is to reduce any terrain to a flat plain, to a first approximation. The reason for that is the higher a given place is, the more it is going to get eroded. And so high areas are preferentially eroded more than low areas, and high areas are brought low faster than low areas are brought even lower. So to a first approximation, if you start out with a structure like that when it's uneroded, and then erode it, you will get this kind of thing. And as a result of the plunging of the folds, where the different kinds of rocks come to the surface will give you these characteristic sinuous patterns. Can you see why that is? Imagine what we're doing is taking a set of tilted folds and running down to a common vertical level within that set. To give yourself a common vertical level, imagine taking a pail of water. To give yourself a set of folds, take a piece of paper, fold it into an S shape, so you got one up and one down, and then slide it into the water, not quite parallel to the surface of the water. Can you see how the water is going to produce an S outlining those folds? Okay. Well, to a first approximation, this is the structure that you would get, and you would know that it's there only because you would walk over the terrain and you would make maps of the rocks, and you would see that the outcrop belt of a particular kind of rock looks like this, but it wouldn't show in the terrain at all. That's because this is only a first approximation. The real situation is that some of those rocks are more easily eroded than others. And so, for example, if this layer happens to be a sandstone, and this layer happens to be a limestone, this layer is not going to be at the same height as this layer. It's going to be higher. It's going to form a ridge. And so the true situation is, in fact, this kind of thing. Here we have layer number 3, which is a layer of sandstone that is highly resistant to the erosion. So it has been broken, it has been eroded away only at the very top. As a result, you have the remarkable situation that, number 1, there is a valley along the crest of that original fold, because only there has the erosion broken through resistant layer number 3 and then been able to get down to low resistance layer, limestone layer number 2, down under it and eat it away. So you have 2 ridges and a valley between them where in the original structure there was only a single fold. Furthermore, you can have situations like this. Ridge number 3 goes up, and here it was really severely folded, so much so that ridge number 3, if that rock were still there, would be all the way up there in the air, but it's not able to be that high up because the erosion has gotten to it, and so what you have is a single ridge along there, and maybe corresponding to it, way over here, there might be another ridge, or maybe not. Maybe the shape was such that number 3 just never does come down again to a layer that is low enough that the erosion is still allowing it to exist. So what I'm trying to show you is, as a result of that sinuosity of the plunging structure, you get these filigrees, and that's the reason for the sinuosity that you saw in the Valley and Ridge Province in Pennsylvania. And number 2, you see each one of these ridges, a number of ridges, one after another, could very well be the same strata, just coming to the surface again over and over. And furthermore, you get many more ridges and many more valleys than you had folds up and folds down in the original structure. The important thing, I'll repeat again. I said it once before, but I'll repeat it again. The important thing to understand, if you want to understand the structure of the Appalachian, the topographic structure that we see today, is that it is determined only indirectly by this underlying geologic structure. The thing that determines where you're high and where you're low is whether high-resistance or low-resistance rocks are at the surface at that place. Now, here is a map which shows, physiographic map, which shows, if I can get in focus, state of Pennsylvania there, outlined, New Jersey, and so forth. We are going to show you a picture which shows this portion of the state, and that will include Reading. It will just barely miss Philadelphia. We'll get a couple of Philadelphia suburbs in the corner. Likewise, just barely miss Baltimore. And the Skylab pictures are very often taken, well, see, they're taken parallel to the orbit trace, and the orbit trace in this case was like this. Skylab was moving in this direction. So you very often end up with this diamond-shaped profile on a map where one corner is north instead of one edge the way you want it. And the way that I have uniformly handled those problems is to place the northeast edge at the top of the screen as you're going to see them. So if you mentally wrench this map around 45 degrees, you will then understand what you're seeing in this next picture. This is the first normal color picture that I've shown you. Here is the Susquehanna River. Here you see the Great Valley, and here you see that gap in the Blue Ridge where the Susquehanna is cut through, and this is the Reading Prong. There are those Philadelphia suburbs, I promise you, over in the Piedmont, and there is the end of the Reading Prong, and then here's the Blue Ridge, as it's called. Here is the Piedmont. It has that characteristic striated structure to it, and I'm not sure of the reason for that, and we have a few suburbs of Baltimore down there in the corner. Now, again, we have this intricate curvature in the Blue Ridge, in the Valley and Ridge Province in Pennsylvania, and you see absolutely ridiculous examples of the river coming down and cutting right through mountains, which it could have missed by going just a few miles out of its way. And you can see from the sinuous shape of the river, it doesn't mind going out of its way anyway. So why in heaven's name has it done this? Well, in the Appalachians, the standard terminology for a place where the river has cut through a ridge is a water gap. I imagine most of you have heard of Delaware Water Gap. It's a national recreation area. Well, maybe you haven't. I don't know. Everybody where I come from would have heard of it because it's right up the road from Philadelphia. Delaware Water Gap is the most famous of the water gaps, and it is where the Delaware River, which is the eastern boundary of Pennsylvania, western boundary of New Jersey, cuts through Kittatinny Mountain. Well, water gaps are caused by the following simple and quite awe-inspiring origin. When the Appalachians had been laid low in one of those cycles of erosion, before the land was uplifted so that erosion could then begin removing material and regenerate them as mountains, when they were laid low, they were pretty much a flat plain. The rivers that you see today established themselves at that time. And then, as the mountains rose up, the rivers stayed where they were and cut down into the mountains. It is possible for a river to climb up to the top of a mountain if you pull the top of the mountain down to almost sea level and then let the river establish itself across the top of that mountain, when in fact the top of the mountain may actually be buried by sediment. So the rivers were there before the mountains were. And as the mountains rose up around them, the rivers simply cut down through the ridges like band saws, producing the enormous number of water gaps that are such a characteristic feature of Appalachian topography. Now, those were of immense importance in the westward expansion in the United States, because it means there were many, many more gaps through the mountains than there would have been otherwise. In addition to water gaps, there is a phenomenon called wind gaps. A wind gap is a notch that has been cut into a ridge, clearly by a river, but there is no river there. And here's the way wind gaps originate. Here is another picture, just to the southwest of the one that you just saw. It is going to include this very, very narrow part of Maryland, that neck of Maryland, where the Susquehanna River, which is its boundary, comes within just a few miles of the Mason-Dixon line, which is a line of latitude in the lower boundary of Pennsylvania. It's amazing how few people realize the Mason-Dixon line, which was the traditional boundary between the North and the South, is the bottom edge of Pennsylvania. South Jersey, by that definition, is south of the Mason-Dixon line, as far as the South. Well, for that matter, historically, New Jersey was a slave state until the Civil War. But getting back to the geology, we're going to see a little bit of Blue Ridge, we're going to see a good deal of Valley and Ridge, and we're going to see some very interesting features in the Valley and Ridge province, some very historic features, too. Here's the picture, color infrared again. Up there at the top, you see the Potomac River, and here you see the Great Valley. This is the Blue Ridge there. There is the Great Valley. Here is the one place in the Great Valley where you have a ridge in the middle of it dividing it into two less great valleys, and that is a place where some clinch sandstone comes to the surface and forms Massanutten Mountain. This portion of the Blue Ridge is Shenandoah National Park, named for the fact that in the portion of the Great Valley between Massanutten Mountain and that part of the Blue Ridge, there is the Shenandoah River flowing. And what I want to draw your attention to, the Shenandoah River is a tributary of the Potomac. It flows, can you see it? It's a little bit hard to see unless you're sitting up front. There it goes, all those meanders. That's the Susquehanna River. The Shenandoah River. And it flows on up like so, and finally flows into the Potomac right there. This region over here, I especially want to draw your attention to, that is Loudoun County, Virginia. Well, if you go along the Blue Ridge, you run into the place where the Potomac runs through, and that's a water gap, and then you run into a number of these wind gaps, where it looks as though something has cut through the ridge, and yet there's nothing there. This one is Snickers Gap. One assumes it was not named for the candy bar. You know that a few years ago, a radio astronomer discovered what at the time was thought to be a new galaxy. That's beginning to look doubtful. But if so, it was hidden from our view by the dust in the plane of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. So we'd never seen it before. The radio waves could go through the dust, but light will not. However, he thought that it was a new galaxy, and if he was right, it would have been the very closest galaxy to our own, even closer than the Magellanic Clouds, our satellites, which revolve around us. And he was looking, of course, for a name for it. Well, he remembered that there is a candy bar called the Milky Way, made, in fact, in Pennsylvania, just above this picture at the Mars Candy Company. And the same company has a number of other candy bars with different components. And so he decided to name the supposed new galaxy Snickers, on the grounds that compared to the Milky Way, it's peanuts.
Oh, that's awful.
Well, that one's Snickers Gap. This one is Ashby Gap. And so you see, I'm sure it was named for the galaxy rather than for the candy bar. Now, actually, that name dates back before Civil War's days. This is Ashby Gap, and this is Manassas Gap, which is famous, named famous from the Civil War. Well, what happened? What happened was this. Once upon a time, the Shenandoah River was a very small creek which only extended about that far, maybe even not that far. And there were, in fact, rivers whose traces you can still see on this Skylab photograph that went through each of these, what are now wind gaps. In those days, they were water gaps. For example, there was one running through here whose lower portion is still barely visible over there. It's called Goose Creek. And there was one running through Ashby Gap whose lower portion is just barely visible, and that is called Gap Run because it extends up towards the gap. And there was another one up there whose name I forget. But the Shenandoah, okay, I have to tell you about a geologic principle called the tendency of rivers to extend their valleys headward. That unwieldy phrase is a technical term. What it means is that if you have a river lying across some terrain, it doesn't just sit there, you know, it's constantly eroding, it's constantly trying to eat into the ground. And it eats into the ground more effectively the fastest that the water is running. And the place on a river where the water is running the very fastest is at its head. Because there is a place where you have no river, and then you do have a river, and at the boundary there's got to be a place where the water runs over the edge more rapidly than it is when it's down in the river. As a result of that, that head keeps eating its way backward into the terrain. And the river has a tendency to extend itself always further in the upstream direction, make itself longer. All of the rivers in a given terrain are trying to do this. Some of them, however, are able to do it faster. And so you may have a time when two rivers are eating their valleys headward toward a common location. Only one is going to be able to win. Only one will be able to drain that location. In the case of the Shenandoah, it was a tributary of the Potomac. And the Potomac was a really major river, and therefore was able to eat into the ground and lower itself really rapidly, which means that a river flowing into it was able to lower itself really rapidly. Because just as a river that flows into the sea cannot eat into the ground any lower than sea level, so a river that is flowing into another river cannot eat into the ground any lower than the place where it flows in. Okay? That's a general rule in river geology. The place where it flows in is called the base level, and the general rule is a river cannot erode deeper than its base level. But if the base level itself is going down because the river it's flowing into is going down, then the tributary is able to eat into the ground rapidly, and therefore it extends its valley headward more rapidly than the other rivers around it. I don't know if you ever had this thought before. Again, an incredible thing could only happen on the Earth. Any given terrain is a battleground where rivers are slowly fighting their way into control or oblivion. Why oblivion? Consider what happened to the creek that was running through what is now Snickers Gap. As the Shenandoah ate its way headward, one day came when it ate its way through the wall which separated its head up to that time from that creek. And then what happened was, all of the water which had been flowing down into that creek was diverted into the Shenandoah. Why into the Shenandoah? Because the Shenandoah was the one with the deeper gradient. Deeper gradient. Therefore, this creek, the lower portion of it, became starved for water, since all that water that had been keeping it fed is now flowing off into the Shenandoah, and it dried up. It's called stream piracy. And there are cases that geologists could point you to in the field, especially in the West, where the landscape is still arranging itself, and in the glaciated areas, where the landscape is still arranging itself, where stream piracy is very actively happening today. But the Shenandoah wasn't satisfied. As a matter of fact, the more successful a river is as a pirate, the more it's able to do this because the more water it has flowing into it. And so it ate its valley. It's now got this tributary flowing into it. It ate its valley further headward until it reached the headwaters of Gap Run, which at that time extended right across there, pirated those headwaters also, and so Gap Run dried up. And later on, it did the same thing to Goose Creek. And right now, the Shenandoah River, still not satisfied, is eating its way further and further down the Great Valley, looking for new streams to pirate. Here we continue our transect across this portion of the Appalachians. I'm going to show you two Skylab pictures in rapid succession. First this one, and then this one, and together they will give you a good view of most of the entire Valley and Ridge Province and most of the Allegheny Plateau. There is the first one, color infrared view. We've got the Blue Ridge there and the Great Valley, those intricate curves of the Valley and Ridge Province, and then a rather well-defined edge to the Valley and Ridge Province, but we have a few low, gentle ridges over there on the west. That's because as the crumpling of the strata occurred, it's not as though there was an absolute cessation of it across one line. There was a tendency for what I have described as the flat, undisturbed strata, which became the Appalachian Plateaus, to be gently folded along their easternmost edges. And in fact, the ridges produced as a result of that, often in many transects across the Appalachians, including this one, include the very highest places on the entire transect. The very highest spots in the Appalachians are way down the south, and they are spots on the Blue Ridge. For example, Mount Mitchell, which is the highest point of them all. That's a relative term. As I mentioned last time, the Appalachians are eroded mountains. They are relatively aged as mountains go on the earth, so they'd be very young anywhere else. And my favorite statistic about that is that there is no point in Grand Teton National Park in the Rockies, including the lowest spot on the bottom of Jackson Lake, that is as low as the highest point in the Appalachians. But nevertheless, as the Appalachians go, Mount Mitchell is as high as they get. But that's on the Blue Ridge. But in most transects, the ones that you get farther north, you will find that the highest spot is on one of these ridges at the eastern edge of the Allegheny Plateaus. This particular ridge, this is in Pennsylvania, it's called Negro Mountain, and its highest point, which is right about there, is called Mount Davis, and that is the highest spot in Pennsylvania. The highest spots in a number of the eastern states are on those gently curved ridges at the eastern edge of the Allegheny Plateau. And then we move over into the plateau. There's Negro Mountain again. There's the last of those ridges. Here's the city of Pittsburgh, where the Allegheny River and the Monongahela River come together to form the Ohio River. That has the characteristic salamander shape of an artificial lake produced by damming a valley. And you can see, as you look at that, and then as you look in the more subtly shown gullied structure all across here, that this is by no means the flat surface that at first it looked like from 270 miles up. It is intricately dissected, but it is not eroded into an organized pattern of ridges and valleys, as is the very easternmost part of the plateau, and is certainly as is the ridge and valley section. It is a disorganized, random kind of up and down terrain, and that is the Allegheny Plateau. The northernmost part of it has been still more modified by glaciation, but that's a different story for a different time. Okay, and this is a good place for an intermission, and so let us have one. It's 9:25, so let's get started again about 9:35. Wallet was left here, and his driver's license is in it, and it's broken right through the middle of the name. Anybody? Oh, it's a student ID? Okay, yes, it is. And thirdly, a gentleman who teaches geography here pointed out to me that when I gave you that history of the settlement through Kentucky versus elsewhere, I messed it up just a little bit. When I said Michigan, I was too far north. Michigan was settled from the northern route, where the Great Valley allows you to go around up over the north instead of... grew up in Philadelphia, where it is assumed that nothing west of the original 13 colonies is really worth studying in a high school history course anyway. And after that. Okay, so that should just about take care of it, I think. And now if we could have the lights off and the slides on, or some permutation or combination thereof. Next slide that I'm going to show you is this area here, which illustrates a typical place in the southern part of the Appalachians, and there things are a little different from what I told you already. I had described the Valley and Ridge Province as being folded mountains, and in the north they are. In the south, however, there is a systematic difference, and we're not quite sure the reason for that difference. It does not show up too terribly well in the Skylab pictures unless you really know what to look for. But the difference is that instead of having a structure which is eroded out of folds that don't have any breaks in them, it's just an up and down all the way across the countryside, there the folds have a tendency to have broken. And so what you have is like this, and then a fault, and another one coming up from underneath like this, and then a fault, and so forth. It's broken, and there are a lot of faults which form boundaries and determine where the various rock strata come to the surface, and whether they're high or low in resistance. We do not know whether the reason for this difference is that the compression was more severe or more sudden or both in the south. I think maybe it's intuitively reasonable, and in fact the geologic laboratory studies show it, and field studies show it, that if you have a relatively gentle squeeze over a relatively long time, what you get is a plastic deformation which gives you folds. But if you really bang it hard and don't give it enough time to relax, then what happens is the rocks break. They act as though they were brittle, and they fragment, and you get faults. And so it may be that that's what happened, or it may be that we are seeing rocks that have been brought up from greater depths below the original surface in the south, and that were we able to remove the ridges and valleys that we see now in the north and dig down even further, we would find the same kind of faulted structure there. Whichever it may be, though, this is the major difference between the ridge and valley provinces in the two places. You will note from the physiographic map, I don't happen to have Skylab pictures that illustrate it well, that the Blue Ridge extends south, it gets wider and wider and also higher and higher, as I mentioned, as it goes, and then suddenly and abruptly ends. And the Piedmont then curls around south of that and meets the Ridge and Valley Province, in fact the Great Valley, directly. So it's very hard to tell where the boundary is when you walk across there between the Piedmont and the Ridge and Valley section, since it happens to be a valley of the Ridge and Valley section. So I don't want you to get the idea that this five-belt transect that I've been giving you as you go across Coastal Plain, Piedmont, Blue Ridge, Valley and Ridge, and Appalachian Plateaus is what you will encounter in every single transect. It is not true in the north, and also it is not true in New England, as I've already mentioned and will illustrate. Aside from that, there is another major difference, which is shown in this picture. Here you see that widened part of the Blue Ridge, and here you see Great Smoky Mountains National Park under a cloud cover, which is a very typical state of affairs for them down there. I wouldn't go so far as to say they're as cloudy as Michigan. I'm not sure anything is as cloudy as Michigan, but they are cloudy a large part of the time. There is the very wide Great Valley with a lake in it that has been created by a dam and shows you there is a river in there. Here's the fairly narrow Ridge and Valley Province, and you can sort of see the effect of what I was talking about in this faulting. There is not the intricate curvature down here. Instead, you tend to have a series of single ridges, and it's not always obvious that one ridge is just the one side of a fold and the next ridge is the other side of the same fold. And then over here, we have the equivalent in the south of that slightly crumpled up eastern edge of the Allegheny Plateaus in the north. This is a large box-shaped region called the Cumberland Mountains. And remember, the plateau in the south is called the Cumberland Plateau. And you can see it's got some rivers flowing across it and so forth. The Cumberland Mountains and the Great Smoky Mountains are examples of one of the most awe-inspiring and least understood phenomena in Earth geology, overthrust faulting. Each of those is a block of land which has detached itself from what is under it and slid horizontally over the land before coming to rest in the present position. The entire Cumberland Mountain block, 125 miles long, has slid to the northwest by as much as 10 miles. And the entire Great Smoky Mountains block, which is smaller, has slid to the west over 30 miles. We cannot understand how this is possible. How can you have such an enormous amount of material moving almost horizontally? What possibly could push it? And part of the problem is there is not any place known on Earth where it seems to be happening today. That gets geologists very, very nervous. One of the guiding principles in geology is the principle of uniformitarianism, which says that things happened in the past the way they happen now, and at similar rates to the way they happen now. And so mountains are not thrust up overnight. Rivers don't suddenly carve their valleys overnight in catastrophic events. Rather, it is slow, gentle, continuing processes, or if the processes are not gentle, like earthquakes, at least they're things that go on all the time in a uniform way, more or less uniform rate. Now, of course, strict uniformitarianism is not true. For example, once upon a time the Earth was created, and now the Earth is not being created anymore. Once upon a time there were many meteorite craters, and now there are not, because the meteorites are mostly gone. And there have been times in the past when there were shallow interior seas over most of the continents. We don't happen to have such a time now. But still, as a general guiding principle, uniformitarianism is valuable, at least for Earth geology, and it is one that geologists, for historical reasons, are very, very upset about any seeming challenge to, in the same way as, for historical reasons, astronomers get very upset at anything which makes it look as though there's anything special about the Earth or about us in the universe, you know, because we got burned a few times by making that assumption. Now we're very reluctant to do it. But there do not seem to be any places where overthrust faulting is going on. I asked a geologist who specializes in tectonics. I don't know if you know what the word tectonics means. There's plate tectonics, but that's just a variant of it. Tectonics just means the study of the large and small-scale movements in the Earth's crust. Mountain building, faulting, earthquakes, that sort of thing. And I asked her the rate at which overthrust faulting happens. You know, was it a slow, gentle kind of process, which makes it even harder to believe how it could have kept up for such a long time? Typical rates of motion along an ordinary kind of fault, say the San Andreas Fault, are of the order of inches per century, if that, you know, and it seems hard to believe that something as heavy as the Great Smoky Mountains could creep along to the west a few inches per century for the kind of time that would have been needed to move them 30 miles. On the other hand, the picture of it happening rapidly, the idea that someday you might wake up and the entire Great Smoky Mountains come barreling down at you at 200 miles an hour is a little disturbing, to say the least, especially since we don't know any cases where it happens to be occurring now. The thought that it might happen someday, a little frightening. She said that we don't know because we don't see it happening today, but the general belief is that, in fact, it goes on at the same kind, at a slow rate, at the same kind of rates of motions you see on other faults. Well, there are some hints as to what goes on. There are many places in the world where it has happened. For example, the Matterhorn in Switzerland is the almost completely eroded away remnant of what was once a large overthrust sheet, and it has moved considerable distance. I don't know the exact distance in that case. If you go to Montana in Glacier National Park, there is a feature called Chief Mountain, which is also an almost eroded away remnant of what may once have been an extensive overthrust sheet. And such an eroded remnant is referred to by the German technical term Klippe, K-L-I-P-P-E. Well, here is one that isn't very badly eroded, so we've still got most of the overthrust sheet. In cases where you see that sort of thing, that is overthrust motion, generally either at the bottom of the overthrust block or at the top of the layer that it has moved over, there is a layer of shale, or sometimes some other rock that is relatively slippery. Shale is a material which you could imagine acting as a lubricant and helping the motion go a little bit more reliable, a little bit more believably than if it were, say, I don't know, sandstone. Seems hard to believe sandstone, you know, with the high friction and so forth. Of course, you can't use your intuition based on small scale, on light very much for this kind of large scale motion. In addition, the motion usually is in the slightly downhill direction. And there are some theorists who think that simply as a result of the massiveness of one of these overthrust blocks, if you manage to get them moving at all, if there is even a slight downhill gradient, even a fraction of a degree, and if there is some reasonable chance for lubrication at the bottom, that in fact the block will keep moving simply under its own weight. It has so much inertia that, like a railroad train, once you get it starting, it takes a while to stop it, you know, and you're not going to stop it, you're not going to stop it from rolling under its own weight very easily on even a slight downhill grade. Question here.
Well, what proof do you conclude that this even happened? What do you see? Layers of rock that should be together but are separated by 10 miles?
Exactly. Or you see, the question is, how do we know that it's happened? Where are the clues that it's happened? What you see is cases where there are blocks that have clearly split off from some, from the rest of the block is still sitting there, but the real clinchers are cases where you see younger rocks on top of older rocks. Now, that just doesn't happen if everything is left to itself. Younger rocks are laid down, did I say younger rocks on top of older? I meant the other way around, of course. Older rocks on top of younger rocks. And normally, in sedimentary deposition, obviously the lowest stuff is laid down first, and so it's the oldest, and then new material is laid down on top of that. And whenever you see a case where there are old rocks, in the case of the Great Smokies, all the way back to the Precambrian, lying on top of young rocks, and in this case, they are the limestones of the Great Valley, and those are of Ordovician age, which is a good deal younger than, something of the order of a billion years younger than the Great Smokies rocks. There's got to be some, and there's a well-defined boundary in between them. You don't have a continuous gradation. Then you've got to look for the mechanism, and and there's just a number of places in the world where this, where you see that kind of thing, and it's generally accepted that it's overthrust faulting. Here and there in the Great Smokies, you can see what the locals call coves, and those are places where the Ordovician limestone is showing through in a sort of window. It's surrounded. It's in a low region, and it's surrounded by the Precambrian older rock. And what's happened there is that erosion has eaten its way down through the older rock and revealed that, yes, indeed, the younger rock is still there. There's another phenomenon in the Great Smokies called falls, which I mentioned just because some of you may have heard of it. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that Great Smoky Mountain National Park is the most visited national park in the United States. Not Yellowstone, not Yosemite, not any of the western parks, Great Smoky Mountain. So I'm sure many of you have been there, and they always point out the balds to you. The balds are not the same as the coves. Balds are places where you have the top or side of a mountain devoid of trees and just grass growing there, and nobody understands what produces them. You have analogous things which are known by different names all through the Appalachians, even up in New England, but we don't really know what the understanding of, what the origin of it is, and it is probably not a geologic phenomenon so much as an ecological one for some reason or another, but just what's going on in those balds, we can't say. Let's go up to New England now. Beautiful Skylab photograph taken with a handheld Nikon camera through the wardroom window of practically the entire states of Massachusetts and Connecticut and the entire state of Rhode Island, of course that's not saying much, and Long Island down there. And I could go on probably for a couple of hours on this one picture, especially if we got into the glacial history as well, but I'm not going to. Instead, I will simply point out a few of the features, one of which is that by now the coastal plain is all underwater with the exception of Long Island and Cape Cod. In other words, the fall line hits the ocean at New York City, as you'll recall, and thereafter the boundary between the Piedmont and the coastal plain, a continental shelf, whatever you want to call it, is essentially the shoreline. The reason for that is that the land was depressed under the weight of the glaciers, and it takes a long time for the land to rebound, come back up to its original height. New England is still tens of feet below where it will finally be. The glaciers have been gone for low these 15,000 years, but New England still hasn't gotten it through its head that it can relax now. It's no longer supporting the weight of a 2-mile-thick continental ice sheet, and it can come back up in the air. And of course, you know how conservative New England is. Well, the result of this is that if you plot the width of the coastal plain plus continental shelf as you go north, it's pretty much constant. As a matter of fact, it tends to get a little bit wider as you go north. But if you plot the portion of it that is above water, it gets steadily narrower as you go north, and those bays become steadily deeper as you go north until finally it pinches out entirely at New York City. The parts of it that are running underwater are the famous fishing banks off New England and then further north off Nova Scotia. And those are relatively shallow places because they were dry land when the material was laid down. And this is material, well, it's a myogeosyncline, material eroded off the Appalachians. So what you see when you look at New England is mostly a very wide equivalent of the Piedmont. Again, the geologists don't use the same name for it, just the way they don't call the Redding Prong part of the Blue Ridge, but it really is, and so I'm going to call it part of the Piedmont. And then you don't have a real equivalent of the Valley and Ridge Province, and you do have some mountains that are sort of an equivalent of the Blue Ridge Province, things like the White Mountains and the Green Mountains in Vermont and so on. It gets complicated and nobody understands all of it, and I don't understand even as much as is understood, but the important thing for you to remember is things are different. It's not the typical structure that I showed you farther south. In this New England Piedmont, there is a superb example of the phenomenon of Triassic lowlands, which I promised to tell you about. And this particular one is the valley of the Connecticut River. The Connecticut River, which forms the western edge of, forms the boundary between New Hampshire and Vermont, then comes down here, runs down the middle of this lowland, this trough, and then does a very strange thing at Middletown, Connecticut, which I'll tell you about in a moment. The Triassic lowland is so named because the rocks in it are of Triassic age. And if you know your geologic timescale very well, you will recognize that that is younger than the 200 million year period at which the 200 million year time at which the Appalachians had stopped forming and the continents began to break apart. Pangaea began to break apart. Well, you remember that I told you quite some time ago that when that happened, the direction of the forces changed from a compressional force trying to squeeze everything together to a relaxation of the tension. In other words, there was a tendency for things to move apart. As a result of that relaxation of tension, a number of cracks developed all up and down the Piedmont, which was the part of the Appalachians closest to the edge, therefore the part that had been under the greatest amount of tension. Those cracks were faults, and they tended to develop in pairs, and in between them, the ground tended to sink down. A region in between two roughly parallel faults where the ground has sunk down is called a graben, G-R-A-B-E-N. And so there are a number of these graben which developed 200 million years ago all up and down the east coast of the United States. Since they were low areas, and since they were surrounded by mountains, the erosion from those mountains deposited material in them, sediments, sandstones, limestones, shales, and so forth. And those sediments are of the age, as shown by fossils in them, when all this happened, and that age happened to be the period that geologists call the Triassic. And so these areas, as a result of the age, these graben, as a result of the age of the sediments that fill the graben, are referred to as the Triassic lowlands. The Triassic was the first of the two periods in which there were dinosaurs. And there were dinosaurs in Connecticut. We have never actually found a dinosaur skeleton, curiously enough, but we have found dinosaur footprints at a number of places in the Triassic lowland, which extends from Connecticut up through western Massachusetts. There were a set of them that were discovered quite recently during what was supposed to be the excavation for a new building, new official building, and so instead they put the building somewhere else and excavated the area for the dinosaur footprints, and you can go and visit that now as Dinosaur State Park in the Connecticut Valley, not very far from the Connecticut River itself. Ordinarily, a river creates its own valley. Early in the history of geology, people observed the fact that rivers are usually found at the bottom of valleys, and there was an argument about whether the reason the river is there is that the valley was there first, and it was a low region, and so the water naturally accumulated, or whether, on the other hand, it's a low region because the river itself had cut it into the land. In most cases, it's because the river itself had cut it into the land. And I've given you some spectacular examples of rivers which obviously had cut their own valleys because they completely ignore the lowlands that are there in the Valley and Ridge Province, and they form those water gaps as they go through the ridges. But here is a place, the Connecticut Valley is a place, where the valley came first, and the river is a river which had its valley pre-made for it. And so it runs down the middle of that lowland. All of which is very nice, except for one thing, which has been one of the classic puzzles of American geology for a century and a half now, and we still do not know the answer to. And that is that at Middletown, Connecticut, where Wesleyan University is, the Connecticut Valley leaves its valley, the Connecticut River rather, leaves its pre-made valley and goes plunging across the hard, resistant rocks of the Piedmont to come out to sea there, not at the base of the Connecticut River Valley, where New Haven, Connecticut is, and where there is, in fact, a small river called the Quinnipiac. But the Quinnipiac does not connect with the upper Connecticut. What happened? We don't know. The obvious suggestion is that the river came first and the land rose up around it in the same way as I explained for the Susquehanna. But then why does the river run so nicely down the middle of the Graben except at that one place? You might say that you've got a case of stream piracy here, where once upon a time the Quinnipiac was in fact the lower part of the Connecticut, and this river ate its way headward and captured the water. Except that the conditions are not favorable for stream piracy. It is much harder for this river, it would have been much harder for this river to erode its way through those tough, resistant rocks of the Piedmont than it would have been for the Quinnipiac to maintain control of the Connecticut River there. Furthermore, if you think the Quinnipiac was once the lower part of the Connecticut River, you've got to explain the fact that if you follow this segment of the Connecticut upstream, there is, oh gee, I guess it's off the slide, but there is actually a river that's lined up with it up there. And so if you believe in piracy, you've got to explain which pirated whom, and it gets very difficult to do that. There is a tendency in this region for rivers to run either north-south, for example, there's one that does that, and there's one that does that, and so on, or to run at this angle here. Don't see another good example of one that's big enough to show up on this slide, but if you look at a map, you'll see what I mean. And the reason for that is that those are the two characteristic directions in which the rocks are cracked in this part of the world. So the fact that the Quinnipiac is lined up with the upper Connecticut may be simply a reflection of the fact that there's a crack there, and we just do not know the answer. The Hudson River does a similar thing, as you'll see in a few slides. Questions?
In the Graben itself, is the dark ridge-like?
Yes, there is. In the Graben,
no, the
border fault is there, and there's another one there, but in fact, both of those faults, the reason that the Graben is visible is, again, that region has been cleared. That's very fertile, and the Piedmont is hard and stony, and it's kind of tough to grow stuff on, and to this day, there's still a lot of woodland up there in New England. It never ceases to amaze me every time I go to New England how much more woodland there is there in this area that was settled so much longer before Michigan than there is around here. But the reason is it's a lot easier to farm a given randomly chosen location in Michigan than it is on that Piedmont. No, what you've got there is you see that there are a number of ridges, and by now you've learned that these dark areas are ridges because they have been left forested. There is one, and there is one, and if I tried hard enough, I could probably find you a few more. Those are ridges of a volcanic rock that is called basalt. And regulars to these lectures have heard basalt in many, many other lectures. Let me show you why it is that they are standing up that way. What happened was, remember, this was the aftermath of a period of mountain building. And so the streams that brought the eroded debris into the Graben, falling over the edge of the Graben as they did so and filling up the Graben with sediments, those streams would lay down a layer of sediments, a layer of sandstone, a layer of limestone, a layer of shale, a layer of whatever. And then you'd have a volcanic episode. And a layer of basalt would be laid down on top of the sediments. And then the volcanic episode would go away for a while, and the streams would bring in still more sediments. And then you'd have another volcanic episode, and a layer of basalt would be laid down. All in all, there were three volcanic episodes, each of which laid down a layer of basalt. And then, at the very end of this period of relaxation, the ground tilted in such a way that all of the layers of sedimentary rocks, which are indicated by this kind of thing, and of basalt, which is indicated by this heavy cross-section, all of those layers got tilted downward to the east. And so, they come to the surface. See, if they'd never been tilted that way, all you'd see at the top would be the upper surface of the very last one, or maybe it might have gotten dissected and you'd see down to lower ones in the river valleys. But as it was, the whole thing got tilted, and so they come to the surface along parallel north-south lines. Here is a block diagram, two places that are 60 miles apart, illustrating the structure at different places in the Connecticut Valley. This one is Massachusetts. There is Amherst, where the University of Massachusetts and Amherst College and Emily Dickinson fame and so forth are. And here is Middletown, Connecticut, where the Connecticut River turns. You can see that these trap ridges, they weren't uniform. They weren't necessarily all along the basalt wasn't necessarily all along the entire graben. But you can see they come to the surface to form these ridges. And I've already used the word trap ridges. Trap is an old miner's term for basalt or a rock related to it. And the general term for these ridges, which you see in many of the Triassic lowlands, all up and down the eastern United States, the general term for those is, in fact, trap ridges. They are high because they are ridges instead of valleys, because the basalt is more resistant than the sedimentary rocks, even the sandstones around it. You can see exactly the same result of a rather different history, where again you've got a tilted sequence of layers of basalt and layers of sedimentary rock, and it has been tilted so you get parallel ridges coming to the surface, parallel layers rather coming to the surface, some of which are ridges and some of which are valleys, and the highest of which are basaltic ridges. You can see that exact same structure in our own Keweenaw Peninsula. It was tilted for a very different reason, but it has the same kind of structure to it. Here's a map. Oh, I'm sorry. Here's a picture in the Connecticut Valley lowland in a road cut through some of the sediments. And there are very few places where you can see regional geology this well in a single road cut. You can see the tilt in this picture. And it's that way in all of the road cuts through those sediments, all through that region. This particular case, we're quite close to one of the two edges where the streams came pouring over. And so you've got some fairly tough stuff in there, and it has resisted erosion quite well. Here is a picture which I took from the top of one of the trap ridges, looking over across the lowland of the Connecticut River Valley. That's not the Connecticut River itself. Those are some lakes that have been built by damming some smaller streams that are in the valley. And you're looking across there over to the next trap ridge over. And this feature is called the Sweeping Giant. You're standing on the Hanging Hills of Meriden. And anybody who is familiar, really familiar with New England has heard of those. The Hanging Hills of Meriden are one of the trap ridges, and others are Talcott Mountain, which some of you may have heard of. There's a very large active science center on Talcott Mountain, Lamentation Mountain, and so forth. The reason for the Sweeping Giant is that there is a fault which has developed through all of these rocks subsequent to the history that I've given you here, and that fault, in fact, comes across the valley, buried under the sediment and the soil so you can't see it, but you pick it up here again. That fault started out life as not a line. Big faults are not single cracks in the rock. Big faults are places maybe a few miles in size for the very large ones, like the San Andreas, where the rocks have gotten crumbled up, and as a result of their being crumbled up, they are easy prey to erosion, and they're very easily removed. In this case, they were removed by a very powerful erosive agent, the glaciers of the Ice Ages. And so you have a nice big chasm right down there over to the left of where I took the picture, and you can see how that chasm is lined up against the neck of the Sweeping Giant. So there's a lot of good geology in this picture. Here's a map of the Triassic lowlands of the eastern United States where they are on shore. Any of you who have really photographic memories and can remember back to the very, very first slide that I showed in this lecture, the one that illustrated the geosyncline off North Carolina, may recall that there was a Triassic lowland in that picture that was now offshore. It said Triassic continental deposits, and is buried underneath the younger marine deposits, which form the Myogeosyncline that I was talking about. But here are the ones that are on shore. Well, there is the Connecticut Valley lowland. What they've actually done here is map the Triassic rocks. And so there are a couple of things that are not strictly the sort of thing I was talking about. This is a defect on the slide. That's not a Triassic lowland. Here is one of them which runs across, called the Newark Lowland, and it runs across all of northern New Jersey and down into Pennsylvania. And that is in the Piedmont, remember, and so that is just inside. There's where the Redding Prong is, and here's where the Blue Ridge comes up. I pointed out the trap ridges called the Watchung Mountains when we saw the first Skyweb slide that I showed you, the wide angle one that showed all the detail of New Jersey, all the detail of the various portions of the Appalachians. And I pointed out the Watchung Mountains, but the most famous of the trap ridges of all of them is a set of trap ridges which happen to come to the surface right there across the west edge of the Hudson River, and those are the Palisades. And everybody's heard of those because they're upstream from New York City. And anything that's near New York City, you've heard of. Name an amusement park in the eastern United States. Coney Island, right? Just not because it's the biggest, but because it's New York City. Okay, and then you got still further of them down there. Not all of them have the trap ridges. Some of them do, some of them don't. All of them have these tilted sediments. And the tilted sediments in the Newark lowland happen to tilt in the opposite direction from those in the Connecticut Valley lowland. Therefore, it has been suggested in the history of American geology that maybe once upon a time those sediments formed a continuous arch like so, that's all been eroded away. However, to the best of my knowledge, nobody believes that anymore. We think that it's just coincidence that, for one thing, you can't follow specific strata across from the one lowland into the other. You don't have strata that are the same kind of rock, the same kind of age, same number of strata, that sort of thing. But it was a nice picture. And here is another famous Triassic lowland over there on the right, this one almost entirely buried underwater, the Bay of Fundy. The Bay of Fundy is one of them, and now you are so far north that as a result of the depression of the land, you have the Triassic lowlands, not just the coastal plain, but even the lowest part of the Piedmont. You have that largely buried by water as well. Here you see a remarkable number of coincidences between the detailed structure of the Newark lowland and the Bay of Fundy lowland. In both cases, you have a dip which gets lower over to the west. In both cases, you've got a trap ridge which comes up and curls around its northern edge, forming North Mountain and Cape Split in the case of the Bay of Fundy, and forming the Palisades in the case of the Hudson. And just a lot of neat little parallels in there. Here is, I think, the most magnificent Skylab picture in my whole collection, and that is an S-190A color infrared photograph of New York City and points west. A lot of the things that I've told you about are visible in this one picture. This is the one that brings it all together. The coastal plain goes out to sea right there, so here is the fall line, not well shown on this picture because to the west of it is not the hard rocks of the Piedmont, to the west of it is a Triassic lowland, the Newark lowland. So there you have that Triassic lowland. This is an artificial lake, so don't worry about whether it's a meteorite crater. These are the Watchung Mountains, which are trap ridges, and there are the Palisades, which are a trap ridge. Next over, you have the Blue Ridge, which up here is the Redding Prong, and so there is the Redding Prong, and you have lots of artificial lakes that have been built up there. Here you have the Great Valley, and the Great Valley extends on up just above this picture. It curves over so that it's going due north. Due north is up there in that corner. And that is the valley of the Hudson River. But the Hudson River also, like the Connecticut River, does this weird thing near its mouth of leaving its previously built valley and plunging through hard rocks. In this case, not just rocks of the Piedmont, but in this case, the even higher and one would think tougher rocks of the Redding Prong. And so the Hudson River does not flow into the Delaware or something down there. It flows into the sea at New York City, and of course that is the reason that New York City is where it is. Again, the same problem as we have with Connecticut. Why did this happen? And again, one of the major unsolved problems in American geology. Next to the west, we have of the Great Valley, we have the only ridge in the ridge and valley sequence in that area, which you will remember is Kittatinny Mountain or Shanga Mountain in New York. Here is Delaware Water Gap. The Delaware River is coming along like so, and it flows through Shanga Mountain, Kittatinny Mountain, whatever you want to call it, down there. And High Point is right there, I believe, on Kittatinny Mountain. It's in this narrow region of the slide. And then coming over to meet this abbreviated valley and ridge province are the mountains that are referred to as the so-called Pocono Mountains, which in fact are especially tough sandstone, which is called the Pocono Sandstone, of the Appalachian Plateaus. So there it is, all together in the one slide. Finally, I promised to tell you about this book, and it is a very fine book, and I think that those of you who have been interested enough to stick with us this far might very well be interested enough to buy the book. It is a magnificent collection of Landsat photographs, most of them in color and most of them in beautifully done color. There are Landsat photographs and there are Landsat photographs, and a lot of the early attempts at coming up with color representations of them, ended up with almost all red, you know, because there was vegetation all over the place and it was dominating. These are not that way at all, except in cases like the pictures of the Amazonian jungle. They're magnificent pictures. Many of them are just abstract works of art. You can picture cutting them out and hanging them over your fireplace or something just as a work of art. In fact, you've seen a number of the pictures from that book if you have been at our earlier lectures where we played the Voyager recording before the talks. A number of the Landsat photographs, which I used to illustrate the various places the music came from as we were playing those recordings. There are a lot of Skylab pictures in there, too, but the Landsat photographs, a number of them were from this book. Mission to Earth, Landsat Views the World. And that's the title, and you don't have to worry about the author in government publications like this. It's a NASA publication, and all of the address that you need to order it is Government Printing Office, Washington, D.C. At last report, it was $14. Now, the Government Printing Office has a nasty tendency of upping their prices all the time without any notice, so when you write off, they may tell you it's $15.10 or some such number, and that's a very typical kind of price for Government Printing Office. They get very detailed prices. They don't round them off. But even so, I think it's a bargain. It's a wonderful thing to give to a friend who might be interested in these things. You know, it's a real coffee table book, and if any commercial publisher put this thing out, I'm sure it'd be $50 anyway. Finally, if we can have the lights on at this point, I promise to tell you where to buy Skylab slides. You can also buy Landsat pictures from here, and you do not need to know the number of the particular slide that you're interested in. All you do is you write off to these people, it's a nonprofit organization. After all, you paid for these slides, right? I mean, you're taxpayers, and the real money has already gone in. So they will supply them to you for simply the cost of reproduction. And nowadays, cost of reproduction is about $1.25. And you get very high-quality slides, as I think you've seen from the ones that I've shown you. All you got to do is tell them the area that you're interested in, give latitude and longitude, or specify a particular city that they could find in an atlas or whatever, and tell them whether you're interested in aerial photography, space photography, or both. You get aerial photographs from the same source. Tell them whether you want slides or transparencies or prints. Tell them whether you want black and white or color. And of course, the most expensive way to do it is to order color prints. You know, those are very much more expensive than color slides would be. But of course, you do need a slide projector to show the slides. Could you put the dust cover back on my slides there, please? Address is, oh, and tell them how much cloud cover you want, and be generous with that, especially for pictures of Michigan. You'll find there are a lot of pictures of Michigan with 10% cloud cover. That's not bad. 10% cloud cover, chances are you'll be able to see the one particular area that you especially love. But if you tell them 0% cloud cover, you'll often find the case of Michigan and some other fairly cloudy areas that they tell you they just don't have any, whereas if you tell them 30%, they'll say that they have a lot. They'll send you a computer printout of everything they've got, both Skylab and Landsat. Or if you like some cheap slides, they have finally given in. They took some time to do this, and they finally got so many requests from people that just wanted a space picture, never mind what, never mind when, you know, not professional users, but just somebody that wanted a pretty picture. They wanted it as a cheap, inexpensive slide. So they've gotten up a nice Landsat photograph, beautifully done with the color. Again, it's not all red in most places, and they will send you a map of the United States, and you say, okay, I want that one, you know, and that's all you need. Those are called Landsat, or the Landsat Selected Frame, something like that. All right, there are two different addresses. There's one place that's better to send off for prints and transparencies and information in general, and for the selected Landsat slides, and that is Eros Data Center, E-R-O-S Data Center, which I'm sorry to say stands for Earth Resources Observation System. And their address is 10th and Dakota Streets, Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Sioux is S-I-O-U-X, Falls, South Dakota, 57198. And if you want to spend a little bit of money on a long-distance phone call, remember, we got an advantage there because they're in the Central Time Zone and we're in the Eastern Time Zone, so you wait till it's 5 o'clock our time and the rates go down, but it's still 4 o'clock their time and they're open, all right? And if you want to phone them, you know, they can tell you right off what they have, you can get feedback, you can get your questions answered right away, and they can do the computer search right there while you're on the phone. They're that well set up. Their phone number is area 605-594-6511. Run those through again. Second? Okay, Eros Data Center, 10th and Dakota Streets, Sioux Falls, S-I-O-U-X, South Dakota, 57198, area 605-594-6511. Now, if you want slides, these super slides that I've been showing, the ones that cover the whole screen there, those are the super slides, are $1.25 each, or at least they were the last time I bought any, from Technology Application Center, University of New Mexico, code 1111, Albuquerque, that's Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87131. Their phone is area 505-277-3622. Technology Application Center, University of New Mexico, code 11, Albuquerque, 87131, area 505-277-3622. I'll give you again the name and address of the books now that we got for the book now that we got the light on. Mission to Earth, : Landsat Views the World. Address, Simply Government Printing Office, Washington, D.C. I forget the zip code, but the post office knows where to find it, believe me. Oh, yeah, they'll give you this incredible amount of stuff, sure. So, thank you very much. I have enjoyed giving these talks. I hope you have enjoyed hearing them as much as I have enjoyed giving them. And I hope that I'll be back. I can't give a whole series this year because I'm expecting to be away for most of the year for all the space events. But I hope to be back at least in September and then perhaps in April or May of next year to update you on at least a few of those events. Meanwhile, those of you who are really turned on, remember there's a whole series of events, mostly lectures, although we call it the Astronomical Film Festival, and all the lectures are by me at Ann Arbor, and the schedule for that's right here. Question right there. Oh, Landsat 3 is the most recent of these unmanned satellites. It is alive and well and in excellent health. And not only is its multispectral scanner working well, but it has a new, improved, high-resolution return beam Vidicon, which is to say television camera. Multispectral scanner is a mechanical scanner that scans one line at a time as you go across the countryside, and that's why the orbit is tilted a little bit with respect to north-south line, and that's why the pictures are all parallelograms. A TV picture, on the other hand, is a single snapshot. And that has been getting some just phenomenal pictures. If you'd like to see them, go to the library and dig out the last few months' worth of Aviation Week magazine. And every few issues, they've got several of them reproduced. There's one of Cape Canaveral. It's just incredible. You can see all of the paths just clear as day. Even better than the Skylab photograph of that area. Now, this is a TV image, but very, very high-quality TV. Say again? Yeah, well, that's the news is very silent about most things that happen on space. However, the one good thing about that is I can make a living out of it. I can go and give you lectures about all these good things. Thank you very much.